From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. What is fodder for a great biography? Is it the subject, inside dirt about that subject, great writing? Maybe it's all three. Librarian Nancy Pearl will be in our studios this hour with some biographical recommendations. As you just heard from Lisa Brooks, Japan's decided to stop importing soft wheat from the Pacific Northwest after a shipment of wheat from Oregon was discovered to include some genetically modified crop. Northwest News Network reporter Anna King joins us now from Richland, where she has been following this story. Hello, Anna.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. I guess the big question is how the modified wheat got into the Oregon shipment in the first place.
That's what everyone's asking. Everybody is very concerned about how this very regulated crop could have ended up in just a normal conventional field in Oregon. Everyone is speculating that possibly maybe it got into the end of a grain bin, maybe it was in the auger that moves the grain in and out of those bins, maybe it was in a part of the tractor and it rattled loose. There's so many ways for this wheat to have moved around in the system, but right now the USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, a branch of the USDA that does these types of investigations, is looking into that very question.
We heard from Amelia Templeton's story that they're starting to test crops all around to see where else this might have spread. But as I understand it, the shipment was from Oregon. So why did Japan stop buying wheat from Washington?
Well, it happens that Washington grows quite a bit more soft white wheat than Oregon does, and Japan actually buys quite a bit of Washington's soft white wheat crop. So it makes sense that some of these growing areas are very close. In some parts of Washington and Oregon, it's just the Columbia River that breaks between the fields. And so I believe that they are concerned that possibly this wheat might have intermingled or, and to be honest, really they've just postponed those sales. They've purchased wheat. They're just saying, don't ship it to us quite yet. We want to hear what this investigation has to bring out.
Why are they so concerned about the inclusion of genetically modified wheat?
Well, a lot of countries around the world are very concerned about genetically modified organisms, and they don't want them in their food chain. And, you know, the U.S. has been pretty aggressive in testing these crops, and they have been accepted in other countries, in some other countries, with soybeans, with corn. But wheat in particular is pretty sensitive. People don't want you to mess with their noodles or their bread. And so it's considered a staple food and a very healthy food. And so people have said, don't mess with our wheat. And so wheat growers actually asked Monsanto or just kind of told Monsanto, hey, you can develop this genetically modified wheat, but we don't believe there's a market for it, and we don't want it in the supply chain. So, you know, maybe you shouldn't study it anymore. And, in fact, Monsanto had stopped studying in field tests, at least, this genetically modified organism quite a few years back.
There were some scientists that were worried about the way field tests are conducted in general, i.e. they're out in a field. And so I think there's been some concern about cross-pollination. Isn't that one of the issues as well?
Yeah, I tried to get a hold of one of the top wheat breeders in Washington State over in WSU in Pullman, and I wasn't able to get him on the phone this morning before our interview today. But that being said, wheat is a crop that pollinates, and so there could be possibly pollination contamination. Now, whether that would carry the gene over to a new area and produce some sort of different crop, I'm not sure at this point, but I'll be bringing more details about that in my upcoming report on this issue.
A last question. I have read that Japan was the major overseas purchaser of the soft white wheat crop from Washington State. So what does this mean economically for the wheat farmers?
Japan is a big market. They have delegations that come in often to check on the wheat supply and how it's being managed, how it's being grown. They organize tours. In 2011 and 2012, they bought about 1 million tons of wheat out of Washington. But that being said, we grow a whole lot of wheat here, and so this purchase that they did not ask to be shipped to Japan only actually constitutes like 1% of their total purchase for last year. So in the grand scheme of things, this sounds like a lot of wheat, but there are still many more countries that this wheat goes to, and this is just a few markets out of overall hundreds of markets that this soft white wheat is going to. Other countries include Asia, Indonesia, the Philippines, China, Latin America, and the Middle East.
So are you saying then they're not as concerned as they might be if everybody canceled their shipments?
Yeah, you know, one boat going out of Portland or Seattle full of wheat not going to Asia is maybe a problem. If that turns into a more widespread problem and more countries cancel their orders, that would be a much larger problem. You know, a 1% of one country's wheat supply that has been postponed is not as big of a deal as if a lot of countries cancel out. That being said, harvest starts around the July 4th. I was out in Pullman just on Friday and driving through those fields. They're looking really ripe, and the wheat is up and really developing well. We've had a lot of nice, cool spring rain to help the wheat crop along this year. And all that grain has to go somewhere. It's got to be put in the bins. It's got to go to the granaries. It's got to get put on boats and trucks. And so if that all backs up, that could become a major problem. But at this point, farmers are concerned, but they're not ripping their hair out quite yet.
So if these tests that Amelia Templeton was talking about, if they actually did find more, I don't want to say contamination, but more evidence that this genetically modified wheat is in other places, that would prompt more concern.
I believe that would be true, that if this wheat is found in, let's say, 15 fields in Oregon or up into Washington, that would be kind of a nightmare situation with a new harvest coming on here in July. But right now, I think the incident has been so far shown to be fairly isolated and that they're managing that very tightly with the USDA and trying to find to the bottom of where the seed got contaminated. Was it at the seed granary with the certified seed? They have this thing called certified seed where, you know, all of the seed that is in a batch of seed that somebody would plant in a field is all certified. This is the best seed. This is this variety. This doesn't have any weeds in it. And so if it happened there, you know, it could be more widespread, or did it just fall off a tractor that was used in a different field? That would be very isolated. They just don't know where in the supply chain
right.
It has happened quite yet.
Well, Anna, we'll be looking forward to hearing your full story soon. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Anna King is Northwest News Network's Richland correspondent. She's been following the story of the genetically modified wheat being mixed in with the regular crop from Oregon and the temporary suspension of shipments from the Northwest to Japan. This is Weekday.
And we're going to have more on food imports and exports and concerns about food safety a bit later this morning. Here's a preview of that.
I'm Orman Alney. On the next To The Point, the bid to acquire Smithfield Food demonstrates how much China wants American pork. From China, the U.S. is getting a lot of its fish and rising quantities of spinach, garlic, and apple juice. Given the plague of food safety scares in China, should the FDA be increasing inspections of imports? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from CareForce, serving Greater Seattle seniors and people with chronic illness since 1999. In-home caregivers, nurses, and geriatric care managers work to help many adults remain safely in their own home. More information at careforce.com.
56 degrees in Seattle. Morning clouds are starting to break up a bit, and we're expecting lots of sun this afternoon with a high of 72. It's 1017. I'm Bernard Ouellette.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. When I was in elementary school in suburban Detroit, our library had a collection of biographies of famous people. I don't remember all the names of the people who were being portrayed, but the books were notable for their illustrated covers. They were dark cameo silhouettes, not pictures, biographies, at least the ones that I remember, are something that are fascinating. They're glimpses into what made people do the things that they became famous for doing. So today on Weekday, librarian Nancy Pearl joins us once again. And we talked memoirs a few weeks ago. So today, Nancy,
yep. Biographies. And I was thinking, the thing that I love about biographies is that you not only get the story of a person, but if it's a really good biography, you get the whole context. So it's a way of understanding history differently from a lot of the way that history is presented. And I'm just enough older than you that my introduction to biographies came from a group of orange books called The Lives of Famous Americans. So there was Betsy Ross and there was Dolly Madison. And really, I think because of those books, that was one of the reasons why I became a history major.
Really? From mm-hmm. those biographies?
From those biographies, which I think if I went back and looked at them now, I would just, you know, like grimace because I don't think they were beautifully written. But I do remember a wonderful biography of Emily Bronte called
wow.
Wild Decembers.
When you were a kid, you
read
this book?
When I was a kid, yes.
So, yeah. Listeners, biographies, as you've just heard us talk about, the childhood biographies we read. There are biographies at all reading levels, I think, even probably
totally.
Some picture books. So we'd like your questions and suggestions for biographies at 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Let me try and spit it out. Or you can email us weekday at kuow.org. And the one book that has been coming into my mind all morning is Stacy Schiff's Cleopatra. And this is the book. I mean, it's one thing to talk about Emily Bronte. There was like written records. But how do you write a biography of Cleopatra?
I think if you're Stacy Schiff, you can write a biography on anything.
Yes.
Because she did a fabulous biography of Nabokov's wife, Vera.
Mm-hmm.
And the best biographies, in addition to giving you that context, they are like page turners. You just want to find out more. And two that I just absolutely loved. One was Robert Massey's most recent book. He wrote Nicholas and Alexandra with his wife, I believe, many years ago. But his newest book is on Catherine the Great.
Wow.
And it came out, it's in paperback now. It won the Carnegie Award for the most distinguished work of nonfiction last year. And it is, I mean, she was a fascinating woman. And there's so many myths and a kind of nastiness going on about her, around her. But this book just really, really gives you a picture of what Russia was like.
So the dirt is part of it.
Well, what he's doing is really debunking a lot of the dirt, especially the most scurrilous parts of Catherine. So that's just a terrific book. I mean, I don't care if I want honesty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it. And if that includes some scandalous episodes and I'm interested in the character, that's fine. I don't want dirt for dirt's sake.
So that's what's different from the sort of celebrity unauthorized biographies.
Yes, which I think are all based on innuendo and that kind of thing. Another wonderful biography, and if people have not read this one, really go read it. Gertrude Bell, Gertrude Bell, Queen of the Desert, Shaper of Nations, or something like that. But it's by Georgina Howell. There are actually two wonderful biographies of Gertrude Bell, who is a fascinating woman. Do you know who she was?
No.
Gertrude Bell was born in the late 19th century and became enamored of everything in the Middle East. and went and learned Arabic. She went to the Middle East. She worked with people like Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
In fact, she's sometimes called the female Lawrence of Arabia. But one of the things that Gertrude Bell did, she drew the map of Iraq. And she is the person who selected who the first king would be. And he was like the third or fourth son of some desert nomad. And she's that important. And so few people, even people, you know, like you who read and who everything. And her life was absolutely, it was amazing. So Georgina Howells is my favorite of the two biographies about her. But there's one that came out a few years before that by Janet Wallach, W-A-L-L-A-C-H. And I know I have the subtitle wrong, but Georgina Howell, Gertrude Bell, that's a match made in heaven.
So who makes a good biography? I mean, what kind of subject? Does it have to be somebody unknown like this?
Well, she was very known in her day. That's true. But she was a woman, so that kind of took her down a few notches, I think. I think that an easier question would be, who is it impossible to write a dull biography of? And the way I would answer that is I would say Theodore Roosevelt. It's impossible to write a dull biography of Theodore Roosevelt. Whether it's David McCullough or you know, the bit parts or little more than bit parts that he plays in Timothy Egan's books, mm-hmm. Everything about Roosevelt is fascinating.
And larger than life.
And larger than life.
Nancy Pearl, as you can hear, is our guest. For the rest of this hour, we're talking about biographies and Bruce emails to weekday@kuow.org. I remember reading shelves of the orange cover biographies when I was in elementary school. It looks like the series for biographies for young readers was revived in the 1990s. The new publisher is Patria Press, P-A-T-R-I-A,
oh.
Press. So you can check those out if you've got a young reader. I just remember they were, you know, they were all really fascinating and just going through. I don't remember that mine were orange. I thought they were red, but maybe I read the orange ones.
Or I'm remembering the ones that I think they did have the cameo silhouettes.
I think it's the same one.
But in maybe the late 1990s, early 2000s, they came out with blue covers.
Okay. Not just to
with
confuse
stars,
us.
And one thing that that series does is those are biographies of famous Americans. You are not going to get anybody who was not tried and true red, white, and blue American in those books.
This is true. Hi, Lindsay in Shoreline. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a great suggestion for a different type a format for biographies, and that is the graphic novel. My daughter's in second grade, and she had to do a book report, and she selected Amelia Earhart. So off we go to the library, and she checked out three books. One of them was a graphic novel, and I sort of, you know, dismissed this as a comic book. And of the three books that she read, this one was by far the best. It had the most interesting details about her life, the era in which she grew up, some really interesting things that she did that I didn't know about. And it really informed her understanding of the character and the era. And she read it over and over again. And I'm now a huge fan. So I encourage parents to look for this series. I got it at the Seattle Public Library in Lake City. And they had lots of other historical characters. And don't dismiss it because it looks like a comic book. The content was fantastic.
Do you know who wrote it?
I don't. We turned it back in a couple months ago, but it had kind of a yellow trim.
Okay.
It's there on the biography section. You can't miss it if you just open them up.
Okay, thanks for that, Lindsay. Now, Nancy, I know you would never dismiss a graphic book.
No, I never would. And actually, we didn't talk so much about graphic memoirs, but there's a whole bunch of wonderful graphic memoirs. But graphic biographies, there's a company called First Second Books.
First Second Books. Okay.
Which are all graphic novels. And they're wonderful, just wonderful biographies in those. There's another there's a biography, I think, that they did, but it might have been drawn in Quarterly or our own Fantagraphics, on Lewis and Clark. And I think it does give I totally agree with the caller. It does give a different perspective.
Bill has an interesting question. Can you comment, Nancy, on the difference between that you see between biographies and memoirs? I don't think I've ever read a biography unless it happened to be an autobiography.
Oh, well, we talked about this a little bit when we talked about memoirs, and someone made the point that a biography is written by someone other than the subject about the subject's life. Mm-hmm. An autobiography, as opposed to a memoir, an autobiography, this caller said last time, encompassed the whole life or a long period of the life, whereas a memoir just covers a particular, often just covers a particular incident. So I think they're very, different.
In terms of biographies and memoirs, do you prefer to read biographies?
I prefer, that's very hard. I prefer to read biographies only because I get a little bit, you know, what I always say is that the first two letters of memoir are me, and I get a little bit frustrated with the self-indulgence that often goes on. That, all that being said, there are some memoirs that I loved.
We're talking about biographies, the self-written right. ones, with Nancy Pearl this hour on Weekday on KUOW, where our phone number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Hi, is it Claudia? Hello?
Hello?
Is it Claudia?
Yeah, it's Claudia. Thanks.
Hi.
Hi, I thought it was interesting what you said about who could you not write a boring, you know, biography, because I'm always looking for a great biography on Benjamin Franklin, and you'd think it would be difficult to do a bad one on him, but I have had really bad luck with that, and I was hoping you could tell me what you thought was the definitive Benjamin Franklin biography.
Well, this is going to sound a little contradictory based on what I just said before this, but I think probably the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, the one he wrote himself, it would probably give you a better sense of the man than many of the books that I have read. David McCullough's book on Americans in Paris has some great stuff about Benjamin Franklin. So I would definitely read that. Other than that, I think I would have to do some digging to see what books are out there and who wrote them for Benjamin Franklin. But I would start with the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin and then, first, the David McCullough book.
When he writes Americans in Paris, I'm assuming that's the era of the Revolution only. Is that correct?
A little bit. No, later too. He covers quite a bit, but it's all 18th and 19th century.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Your call. Well, David McCullough, you probably can't go wrong with his books.
No, whether he's writing a biography of the early years of Theodore Roosevelt or a biography of the Brooklyn Bridge or the Panama Canal.
All pretty interesting.
He's great. He's wonderful on that.
Theater and dance writer Alice Caterlin called in. She recommends the writing of Henri Troyat, T-R-O-Y-A-T.
Boy, I have not heard that name in decades, Alice. And didn't he write about the monarchs of France and Europe?
I
think that's when I read them. But boy, I could not even comment on that.
Well, thanks for that call. She couldn't hold. Lucy writes, Robert Caro's Lyndon Johnson biographies are justly celebrated. I don't even remember what volume he's on now.
Fourth.
But she would like people to be reading What It Takes by the late Richard Ben Kramer to encounter one of the most full-throated, exciting biographical accounts of the presidential candidates of 1988. If you have zero interest in the likes of Bob Dole, George Herbert Walker Bush, Mike Dukakis, and that uncolorful field of candidates, you will be amazed. I read it with the breathlessness of a great novel. I had to tell my mother I needed to get off the phone. I needed to see what was going to happen to Bob Dole next. Well, that is a great recommendation.
And Richard Ben Kramer was a wonderful writer.
What It Takes Have you read this?
I have not read it, but I'm going to go out right now and get it from the library.
But Arwen Nix, producer of The Conversation, has read it. And if she says thumbs up, I take that as, I mean, breathless. It left me breathless. I had to, I couldn't take a phone call because I had to finish it. I love that. It's a recommendation.
Great.
Sounds really good to
me.
Joan says, I was fascinated by the biography of Maimonides by Herschel. He was a Jewish legal mind doctor and politician at the height of the Islamic Empire, doctor to Saladin, an amazing discussion of Islam, Christianity, law, and medicine.
Sounds interesting, too.
I know. I think, well, there's no shortage of topics.
No. And that's one of the nice things about biographies is basically, if you're interested in someone who made the least little dent into the history of the world, you're going to find a biography.
We're talking biographies this hour on Weekday. Hi, Amy in Paulsbow. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, you're on.
So I was going to talk about Coco Chanel. And my daughter had to do a History Day project, you know, National History Day competition on a person, and her partner chose Coco Chanel. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that someone becomes famous for something, but you really don't know their story. And like for Coco, it was a children's book that probably did the best job of outlining kind of what made her who she was. So I think one thing that I guess I'm trying to say is that the person who is famous for something, looking back on where they started and where they got to where they are, is part of what makes, I think, the biography so incredibly fascinating.
That's true.
Yes, and I think the caller made another good point. Oftentimes when you have a little bit of interest in a person, but you're not sure whether you want to commit to these 500-page biographies, start with a children's book. When I was growing up, and Marcy, when you were growing up, there was not a lot of good nonfiction.
No.
And now nonfiction is a terrifically important part of a children's publisher's
their catalog.
Catalogs.
Huh. Thanks, Amy, for that call. Appreciate that. I have a question about the person who writes a biography, whether it's for young adults or even younger readers or my age readers. Do you have to be a historian to write a biography?
I don't think you do. I think you just, in fact, I think some of the best biographies are not. I think you have to be someone who enjoys reading and writing about history, but I don't think you need to be a historian. And I just recently interviewed Nathaniel Philbrick, whose new book is on Bunker Hill.
Right.
And I asked, and I described him as a historian, and I said, is that accurate? And he said, no, not really. That really, he's just someone who loves to write about history, loves to research it, loves to write about it. And there's a man named Ross King who does whose newest book is about Leonardo. And my best understanding, if I'm remembering correctly, is that he also is not a credentialed historian. And really, in some ways, what you most need if you're going to write a biography is you need a feel for the person, and you need You also need to be able to connect with your readers.
Hmm.
So, you know, the worst biographies are these dry biographies that just list dates and times and things like that. What I think readers want to get is a sense of the person.
And it seems like you need some of the skills of a historian just to do the research.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, well, gosh, Leonardo, then you can go to Italy
right.
and do a little research.
Yes.
Maybe I should become a biographer. Bob says, I recently read Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy by Eric Metaxas. I was aware of Bonhoeffer, but it's a very rich book about an amazing man, and it helps one better understand how Germans were able to support Hitler. The author was in Seattle recently. I was surprised at how funny he is, in addition to being a good speaker. So then I read Amazing Grace, William Wilberforce, and the Heroic Campaign to End Slavery, also by Metaxas. Wow! This is a powerful book about one of the great statesmen of the 18th and 19th century, an almost disabled man who was an incredible speaker, speaking for hours at a time in Parliament. And he strongly recommends both books by Metaxas.
Uh-huh.
Am I saying his name right?
I think so.
Eric Metaxas. There's Metaxas. So you've read?
I have not read the Bonhoeffer one, partly because I think it would be too depressing. And the Wilberforce one, I've read about but have not read.
I lived in the area of Ohio where Wilberforce, there's a Wilberforce, Ohio, uh-huh. and it's an African-American college there. So uh-huh. that's the only reason I knew the name at all. We go to Ellen on Bainbridge Island now. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. I wanted to recommend Sweet Swan of Avon, did A Woman Write Shakespeare by Robin Williams. And it's a portrait. Well, first they deal with the question of why we don't really know who wrote Shakespeare's plays. And then this woman was an amazing countess of that particular time, and it makes a strong case for the fact that she could have. There's no evidence she did. But so it's an account of a very interesting woman.
And I wonder how you chose to read that book.
I saw in Bellevue on the bookshelf, and the title just caught my attention, and I thought I'd like to read more about it, since I know there's been long time questions about who was the author of the Shakespeare plays.
I love hearing about how people discover the books that they discover.
Ellen, thanks for that call. I sometimes think that you can tell a book by its cover.
Oh, I totally agree.
It's not, you know, sometimes you know something's going to be kind of cheesy by
right.
certain
oh, yes.
covers, but other times you're intrigued by whatever the design is. And
yes. And often, I mean, one way that I judge a book by its cover is that if the author's name is bigger than the title, you know, is in a bigger font than the title, then I don't read it because I figure it's going to be one of the bestsellers and there's no reason for me to read it.
Nancy Pearl, there, you've just gotten a gem there. Nancy Pearl is with us, the author of the Book Lust series, host of the Book Lust television show on the Seattle Channel, regular contributor to Weekday. We'll be back talking about biographies here on KUOW.
There's a lot more about biographies on KUOW's website. A couple that come to mind are exclusive KUOW interviews with biographers who've written about Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain, even P.T. Barnum. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Go to KUOW.org and search biography. You'll see what I mean. Lots of fascinating life stories to sift through.
Support for KUOW comes from Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, announcing the opening of a new office in Montlake Terrace to serve patients from Snohomish and North King counties with retinal problems such as macular degeneration. More at vrawashington.com.
55 degrees in Seattle. Sky is cloudy. Forecast calls for sun this afternoon and a high today of 72. It's going to be sunny again tomorrow on Tuesday with a predicted high of 79.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. An update on the California wildfires in our top of the hour newscast, which is 20 minutes away.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Nancy Pearl is with us once again, and we're talking today in particular about biographies and all their many permutations. We've heard about graphic biographies, which I have to stop myself from saying graphic novels, because graphic biographies. We've talked a lot about biographies for kids. And Keith says, don't forget audiobooks. There's a great series called Philosophers in 90 Minutes. Each covers a different great mind, from Descartes to Plato to Nietzsche to Confucius. I'd like to know how you do a biography of Confucius. That would be interesting. Joe, in the Maple Leaf neighborhood, you are on the air.
Hi there. I had a question for you, Nancy. If you have any suggestions on a good biography for Einstein.
Oh, yes. One that I would, the newest one that's out there, is by a man named Walter Isaacson. And he also wrote the biography of Steve Jobs. Huh. So he's a real, that's one of the things that he does and is able to make his characters very interesting. So that That Walter Isaacson one, we should probably check if that's really, if he did really write that. But I'm pretty sure it's by Walter Isaacson.
Okay, so I'm going to sick Amina, producer Amina, on that to check it out and give us the real scoop. So you would recommend that because he likes...
He knows what he's doing.
Okay. Well, so that's a criteria.
That's a criteria.
Start there. We go from Maple Leaf to Bellevue, where Z is on the line. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
When you guys mentioned the Lyndon Johnson books by Robert Caro, that reminded me of The Power Broker, which is also by Robert Caro, and it's about Robert Moses, who basically shaped modern-day New York and did a lot of things that he would never be able to do in Seattle, just basically destroying neighborhoods to build bridges and so forth. And it's a really fascinating book if you're at all interested in urban planning or how cities come to look like what they look like.
You are so right. I mean, that book, I meant to say something about that when we talked about the Lyndon Johnson one. This was Robert Caro's first book, I believe, The Power Brokers, The Power Broker. And just, you know, what was said about the power that Robert Moses had in making these decisions and in really altering the face of New York. And also, there's been some more recent stuff about comparing Moses to Jane Jacobs, which is very interesting to read. So, you know, I think beyond city planning, I mean, I think that anybody who's interested in the way politics works and the way we want to think about our urban areas, I think both The Power Broker and the new one about Jane Jacobs and Moses would be great. So if you haven't read that one, do pick that one up. Jane Jacobs was an amazingly interesting person.
And her philosophy a little bit different from Robert Moses's came to designing a city. Thank you so much for that, Z. Joe in Maple Leaf, the book by Walter Isaacson is called Einstein, His Life and Universe.
Yes.
So go check that out. And then did you read the Steve Jobs bio?
No, I have it at home. I have not read it yet.
Lynn says, West with the Night is her suggestion. And
oh, yeah. West with the Night is the story of Beryl Markham.
I couldn't remember her last name.
But didn't she write it?
I thought it was an autobiography.
I thought it was an autobiography, right? Okay.
But it's still a good book.
But it's very good.
So
yes.
We put that on the last list from 2 weeks ago. Nancy Pearl's with us here, and our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, 206-543-KUOW. Hi, Greg in Northgate. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi, I have two questions. First, I wanted to suggest a biography I just finished, but I also wanted to ask Nancy, since she's so well-read, if she can tell me the name of a book that I might have been given by my mother as a child, Northwest Theme, about a very young woman whose husband, I think, was killed suddenly. Maybe he was a pilot. And she spent that summer canoeing or something around the San Juans or the coastal islands with her very young children.
Yes,
yeah.
And I've forgotten the name of it. It was very well in my memory, and then I'd like to read it again decades later, but I forgot it.
We were just talking about that 2 weeks ago about memoir, because it is a memoir, and it's a fantastic book. And I know people listening know which one we're talking about. She was on a powerboat in the 30s or 40s before the islands were settled. Is that, Greg, the book you're thinking of?
Yes, and she was sort of gunkoling around with heavy fog, and it was very sort of...
It's a great book.
Thrilling, and
it's not like Curve of Time.
Oh, yes, The Curve of Time.
The Curve of Time.
That's it. Let's just double check that. But The Curve of Time, I believe, is what the book is. But another one that you might also enjoy is by Constance Helmerichs, Helmerichs, out of print, but it's called Down the Wild River North. And she takes her kids on this amazing, amazing trip deep into northern Canada and Alaska. It has the same feeling.
You know what? You're making me feel like a horrible mother. Amina, it's called The Curve of Time, says Amina. It's a great book. I just read that, Greg, and it's by Wiley Blanchett, B-L-A-N-C-H-E-T. But Greg, you had another recommendation too, right?
I did. I wanted to just jot down this other Down the Wild River North was by Helmerichs.
Yes. Constance Helmerichs.
Constance. Okay, thanks. The one that I just finished, which was, I thought, fabulous, just told you so much about a person that was just so crazy about something. He devoted his entire life to it for no gain, was Egan's recent biography of Edward Curtis.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just an unbelievable story about somebody who spent his entire life devoting himself to detailing the Indians and their culture, and mainly their languages is what he saved, their languages and also pictures of them. It was just, I think, a remarkable story about somebody who gave himself to his obsession his entire life.
What was the name of that book?
It was called, I think, something like The Long Nights of the Shadow Catcher, I think, by Tim Egan, who wrote The Good Rain. And
he's a great writer.
Yeah. I think it's Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, but I could be wrong.
But you can go to Tim Egan, E-G-A-N, and find out whatever his most recent book is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a wonderful suggestion. And I'm happy to say that that's one of the finalists for this year's Nonfiction Carnegie Award.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for those suggestions, Greg, and for the question about the curve of time, which we did talk about. Dick says maybe FDR wasn't as larger than life than Teddy, but he presided over a fascinating period of history. Two bios I enjoyed, No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns Goodwin and Roosevelt and Hopkins by whom? He says maybe Robert Sherwood.
The Sherwood doesn't sound familiar, but I agree that the whole period of the New Deal and Roosevelt's kind of breaking with his family tradition to run as a Democrat are really vital. But what I enjoyed the most about No Ordinary Time was his wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Dick says.
Oh, yeah,
it says,
yeah.
It shows how important both his wife and Harry Hopkins were during his administrations.
Yes. And there's a wonderful biography of Eleanor, many good biographies, but the one that I think is just absolutely splendid is by Wise, W-I-S-E, and I think it's just called Eleanor Roosevelt.
There was one I read that was called Eleanor. But maybe I'm hallucinating.
Oh,
here.
Well, I could be hallucinating.
Maybe it was that one. I don't remember. As you mentioned, there were a lot.
Blanche Wise, I think her name was.
That sounds familiar. Devin on Vashon Island, thanks for joining our conversation. Devin?
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to, I'm a tutor on Vashon Island to middle school and high school kids, and biographies are one of my favorite sorts of books to recommend to parents of children who don't read. It's almost magical when you take a kid up to the adult biography section and they see all those names. And they're always surprised to see names that they recognize. Because I think a lot of times they don't, especially the non-readers, don't think the library is for them. And of course it is. And also just to see history in terms of people. I remember meeting Karen Cushman, young adult historical fiction writer who happens to live on Vashon. And she told me, and I asked her why she became that sort of writer. And she said that she found when she was in school that history was so boring. It was all about wars and dates. And what she wanted to know was about the people, and especially the children. And that's why she started writing the sorts of books that she writes, like Midwife's Apprentice. And also what Nancy said about children's biographies. Any kind of children's book is a great way to introduce any subject to a child, no matter what their age. To a child who's resistant or just beginning to learn something. Like recently, I recommended a children's picture book. I don't know what it was. It was some scientific subject. And it just made it so much more simpler to read and less overbearing as adult books, nonfiction books can be. And it's also a great transition from fiction to nonfiction. Biography is for kids, and especially with summer coming up, such a terrific reading time.
Well, thanks for that. Was a lot of suggestions, Devin. Appreciate that.
Good points.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm sort of hallucinating here. It's Sherwood is the author of other
Roosevelt and Hopkins.
Yep. So got that down. What about the book King of the World?
Oh, the Muhammad Ali by David Remnick.
Is that a biography?
That's a biography.
Okay.
Now, there is a brilliant biography that
eliminated all sorts of things.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a fabulous. And if anybody has missed that book, whether or not you have an interest in boxing or in Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, David Remnick's writing is just splendid. Mm-hmm. And, he's now the editor of The New Yorker. He was a writer for them when he wrote this book, not the editor. And it's what a biography should be.
Besides wishing that you'd written every sentence in the book.
Yes,
it's a great
absolutely.
History of the civil rights movement in the United States,
yes.
Among other things. Here's an email. Hi, my name is Natalie from Wedgwood. I just wanted to say I get the e-newsletter Shelf Awareness a couple times a week. They do a great job, a lot of biographies and memoirs. They recommended Everest, The First Ascent. Is that a biography?
It's a biography of the people who ascended it first.
Donna says Blanche Wisen Cook wrote Eleanor Roosevelt.
Okay.
So you were close.
I was close.
We go to Bothell next, where Gil is hanging in on the line. Hi, Gil.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm great. So I have two suggestions. The first one, and perhaps you've never heard of either of these, one is a memoir by a man named Jan Joers, Y-O-O-R-S, called The Gypsies, and it's about a Belgian boy who was allowed by his parents to live with the gypsies for extended periods of time, starting when he was 12. So it's an amazing insight into gypsy culture and Belgium and Europe before World War II, and he just gained amazing knowledge of gypsies and their customs, and it's a very warm and fascinating book. He later on, he went on to become a resistance fighter in World War II, and I highly recommend it. There's one other one that I would really like to mention called A Life of Her Own by Emily Carl, Carles. She was born about 1900 in the French Alps, I believe, in a really insular, restricted, small community. And she went from being someone who lived in really dire circumstances to becoming a formidable force in France. She went on to become not only a teacher, but a feminist, a pacifist, a political activist. But it's a beautiful blend of a coming-of-age story and growing up in a very simple village where she would go visit relatives in the summer by being tied on the back burro that knew the way to another village.
Wow.
She was three, and that's a totally different time, of course. And she was born in 1900, lived to about 1980, I believe, and it's a brilliant story of, the awakening, the intellectual awakening of this woman. So
okay.
I highly recommend both of those. They're not very well known, but they're kind of the warm and fascinating memoirs of people who, found out a lot of things that many of us don't know or can't.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Gil.
They sound great.
Yeah, really, really book people I've not heard of.
I think you would like A Life of Her Own, though, because I did read that one.
And that's Emily Carl.
Yeah.
Here's a nice, very juicy one, so get out your pencils. Dave in the Ravenna Bryant neighborhood says, two of my favorite biographies are Bob Spitz's Deary about Julia Child and Jack Nisbet's book The Collector about David Douglas. It was the U-Bookstore promotion around the 100th anniversary of Julia's birth last summer or fall that turned me on to Deary. I couldn't put it down. My wife had read My Life in Paris, which I think is a memoir.
Life in France.
In France.
Yeah.
Also, thanks to a recent trip to Monument Valley and Canyon de Shelly in Arizona, I'm trying to learn more about the lives of the Marine Code Talkers, and I'm reading a biography of one of the last to survive, Chester Nez. It's Code Talker in the first person, but basically crafted by Judith Scheiss-Avila. from hours of interviews about the subject.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing? We've had such wonderful suggestions.
I know. A lot to read. And then Sheila said, just as we're talking about the New Deal, the woman behind the New Deal about Frances Perkins. I'm out. I have forgotten the author, but she just wanted to make sure that we gave
that
props.
That was on People's, yes.
So who was Frances?
Frances Perkins was the head of the Department of...
Well, now I'm going to have to read the book,
I want to say agriculture. She was the first woman appointed as the head of
any department. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so, Nancy, I feel like I need you to make a whole a whole program of biographical reading for me so that I'm up on my history, because, you know, we've had a lot of suggestions. We've taken them down, and at some point they're going to appear on our website once the producers get them all typed up at kuow.org/weekday. Nancy Pearl is the author of the Book Lust series of books. She hosts Book Lust, the TV show on the Seattle Channel. She's here this summer coming in sort of in the mini Nancy version every couple of weeks to bring us some summer reading recommendations. So maybe I'm going to task you with biographies for me. And you hear her from time to time on NPR's Morning Edition. Always great. Now I'm all psyched, ready to read.
And I do have the first one on my list for you, Marcy, which you will love because it's set in France.
I will love it. You're right. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Amina Alsadi, Jason Pagano, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. And speaking of books, Seattle Times writer Linda Mapes will join us tomorrow to talk about the restoration of the Elwha now that the dams have come down. So we're going to be talking to her about that.
How does the government and business learn about you? We're going to get into that today at noon. KOW's Ross Reynolds will be talking with Chris Segoyan. He's with the ACLU, and he's done work exposing government spying on internet communications and mobile phones. Segoyan's been called a Ralph Nader for the internet age. Again, we'll be talking with him today at noon. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from United Way of King County, joining with the Seattle Mariners for an all-star celebrity softball classic for homeless youth on June 15th at Safeco Field. More information at unitedwayofkingcounty.org.
Above us shone a star that we called the sun, and we called the ground the earth. So we named everything, including ourselves. We were man and woman, and when we got lonely, we figured out a way to make more of us.
This week on Selected Shorts, Kira Sedgwick reads an unusual love story from PRI, Public Radio International.
Short stories read over the radio tomorrow night at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting opening night with physicists Brian Green, Adam Frank, and Sean Carroll, and the West Coast premiere of Icarus at the